This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, What Next listeners, I have a special announcement for you. For a limited time, you can now get 6 months of Slate Plus for just $29. That is 50% off. As a member, you will get no ads on any of our podcasts, including this one. You'll also get unlimited reading on the Slate website and member-exclusive episodes and segments from shows like Slow Burn, Amicus, Political Gabfest. Slate's podcasts, like this one, cover major news events, from elections to social issues to historic court decisions. Our shows also discuss what makes a song a smash, analyze what's going viral, decode cultural mysteries. If we have become part of your listening routine, we ask that you support our work by joining Slate Plus. Sign up for Slate Plus now at slate.com/whatnextplus, and you can access all of Slate's content and support our work. Again, it's just $29 for 6 months through October 28th. So sign up now at slate.com/whatnextplus.
The war in Ukraine is dragging on, and I've been wanting to understand the toll of Russia's bombardment from someone who's witnessed the brutality up close. So late last week,
hey, good evening,
I called up Dr. Samer Attar.
Or Sam, it doesn't matter.
Dr. Attar is an orthopedic surgeon. Most of the time, he practices in Chicago. But earlier this year, he traveled to Ukraine as the Russian invasion began.
I was in Kiev right at the start, around March, and I was working in an orthopedic hospital, and we were probably doing around 10 operations a day on war wounded.
Some of Dr. Attar's descriptions are going to be a bit graphic from here on out.
A lot of fractured bones, mangled limbs, blast wounds. A lot of what you do as a war surgeon is just cleaning up wounds and trying to get broken bones to heal and trying to get areas of muscle that are exposed covered.
These wounds were very familiar to Dr. Attar. That's because in 2013, he began traveling to Syria to treat people injured in that country's civil war.
Now, the UN human rights chief says the death toll in Syria now tops 60,000. Navi Pillay saying the number of casualties is much higher than expected and truly shocking.
In the outskirts of the Syrian capital, the devastation of the war is clearly visible.
It's worth remembering, Russia has been deeply involved in the Syrian civil war. Since the beginning of the conflict, Vladimir Putin has backed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In 2015, Putin's support turned into military intervention, with Russian forces dropping bombs on hospitals, schools, and residential neighborhoods.
Anti-regime forces and civilians targeted with more than 500 missiles and hundreds of shells, according to an observer group.
CNN. Now, Dr. Attar is seeing some of the same tactics he witnessed in Syria play out in Ukraine, where just a few months ago, he saw the human cost.
There was one little girl, I think she was about 14 or 15, but she lost her right leg and had a fracture in her left leg, and she just spent the day watching episodes of Bridgerton because her right leg was amputated and it was infected and she was requiring multiple trips to the operating room to get cleaned up and washed out.
There's something very surprising and even sweet about that particular image.
Yeah, there was just something sweet about her. She was stuck in the hospital and just was sitting calmly, understanding that she was probably going to be there for another month, getting her legs cleaned out until her wounds could get healed and closed.
Today on the show, one doctor's efforts to repair the wounds inflicted by war and what he's noticed in two different countries scarred by Russian bombs. I'm Mary C. Curtis, filling in for Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Dr. Samer Attar has gotten used to traveling into a war zone. He started these kinds of trips in 2013, after the civil war began in Syria. He's a member of the Syrian American Medical Society, and the group was arranging for its doctors to go over and help.
For me, for Syria, that was my heritage. So I grew up going to Syria. My parents are from Syria. And when I learned that doctors were being targeted and assassinated and hospitals and ambulances were being targeted and destroyed and that they were running out of medical staff, being an American, being born and raised with the luxuries of being a United States citizen, I just felt obligated to give back. So it was my way of giving back to a culture and heritage that has made me special, made my upbringing special. They said they needed a surgeon in Aleppo, and if I wanted to go all the way in, they could get me in, just as long as I understood the risks. I found myself being smuggled across the border into Syria. The war had been ongoing for about 2 years at that point. And yeah, I mean, the first time I went in, I wondered what I was doing and why I was there. And I was scared to death. But once I got to the hospital, I met the chief surgeon. The first thing he did was give me a big hug. And he said, "Thank you for coming to Syria to help." Mm. I just changed into scrubs and immediately got to work.
Well, I know you were only supposed to stay for a couple of weeks. Was there a particular moment that made you decide to stay longer?
I was there my third day, and 3 days in, there were a lot of attacks, and there were a lot of patients coming through the doors, and we were operating a lot, and a school was bombed. It was Ramadan at the time. At one point, the emergency room was overrun. There were so many people trying to get through the front door. There was no place to step. We were placing patients on the floor because we didn't have enough beds. And there was a kid who had the bone fragments of other people that had embedded into him, which was not uncommon to see. And in these explosions, other people would blow up into each other. And that was horrifying to see. And one of the nurses was trying to help dislodge some of these fragments. And I remember the boy's father asked the nurse who I was, like, who is this person? Why does he not speak Arabic very well? And where is he from? And he said, "Yeah, this is Dr. Sam. He's an American." And the dad said he'd never met an American and he never thought he would. He never thought it would be when people were leaving Syria and an American doctor came to help. That for me was very meaningful. I stayed for 2 weeks. And I tried to make it a habit to go for a week to two a year after that. And I also volunteered to sign up for Doctors Without Borders for more extended missions at the border. The longest I took off was 6 weeks. And that's hard to balance, too, because you're balancing your practice here in Chicago, my practice here in Chicago, and my patients, but also the needs and the connection I felt working there.
Did the child with the bone fragments from the blast from other people, did he make it?
He made it.
How'd you feel?
I mean, that feels good. You see a lot of people die. You bear witness to the worst of humanity. And then one night, I do remember strangers brought in a kid who was found after an airstrike. He was found alive, but unconscious in the rubble. And they brought him to our hospital because it just happened to be the nearest one. And everyone was working together. They were doing CPR on him. And one surgeon was holding this boy's femoral artery with his fingers because the child had a huge wound with a broken femur and an obliterated artery. And they actually revived him, and we fixed his fracture, and he woke up and told us what his name was. He told us who his dad was, and his dad came to the hospital and found his son. And that was a win, because a lot of times children, or just people, civilians, would be caught in these attacks and would be dismembered or disfigured or burned beyond recognition and never identified, taken to be buried, and family members would never know what happened. So this dad got to come to a hospital and find his son and never left his side. And it's those memories that I try to keep with me to balance out all the other horrors that you witness.
You've got to take those wins when you can.
Yeah. A lot of what I did as an orthopedic surgeon were just taking care of leg and arm wounds. So people would come up with skin and muscle missing, with exposed bone, oftentimes associated with fractures, and a lot of amputations. I've done more amputations than I ever care to do, but that's a lot of what we did. We were either cleaning out wounds, cleaning out amputations, redoing an amputation, or dealing with freshly wounded.
After the break, why Dr. Samer Attar began taking his wartime operating experience to Ukraine.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
And it would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights. Gay rights now! Gay rights! With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This past February, as the Biden administration began warning that Russia was getting ready to invade Ukraine, Dr. Samer Attar began preparing for a possible trip there.
I had a feeling I'd be volunteering even before the war started. We all heard about the Russians mobilizing, and we all had a sense that Ukraine was going to be at war at some point, at least reading the news. And I just had a sense that I'd be involved. I just felt obligated after what I had seen and done in Syria and having been under Russian bombs before and having dealt with those war injuries and those war wounds for years, I just felt obligated to go help out.
Tell me more about what it was like when you first arrived in Ukraine, what you saw, how it was.
I remember being very quiet. I first went to Lviv, and then I took a train into Kiev, and I just remember the curfews, and I remember the streets being empty, and then The environment would be punctuated by air raid sirens.
Russia, of course, is a common denominator in both of these conflicts, and they've been criticized for intentionally targeting civilians. How have the injuries you've seen in Ukraine compared to what you saw in Syria?
Yeah, so they're high-energy blast injuries. They're the same. I mean, the injuries I saw in Syria are exactly like the injuries I saw in Ukraine.
A lot of those injuries come from what are called cluster bombs, munitions that get dropped from the air and break into pieces, hitting multiple targets in one shot. Cluster bombs are technically banned from being used on civilians, but Russia has used the weapons in both Syria and Ukraine, and the damage they leave behind can take a long time to diagnose.
It's a lot of little bits and pieces of metal and shrapnel that sort of shotgun blast into the human body. The other thing to keep in mind is that the wounds are constantly evolving, so that most of the time, you have to leave the wounds open because muscle that looks alive on day one might not make it and might die on day five. So the zone of injury is never really present upon immediate presentation, which is why one of the principles of war surgery, for example, if somebody came in with an amputated leg, you don't close the wound, you leave it open and let the muscles declare itself, because over time, due to the high energy blast of the injury, the muscle can necrose. It can take up to 5 days for it to declare itself. And so that's why you're oftentimes going back to the operating room to cut more tissue, debride dead tissue, before you can make the decision to close a wound.
But despite these similar injuries, you've also noted there was some big differences between the two conflicts, particularly the status of the healthcare infrastructure in Syria compared to Ukraine. You've said that even though Russia has targeted hospitals, Ukraine's healthcare system is still largely intact, while Syria's was completely decimated and you were doing surgeries all over in basements, underground. Can you describe that difference?
Yeah, so in Syria, wearing a red cross or a red crescent or wearing scrubs made you a target. So symbols of medical neutrality became targets. And that's why healthcare was driven underground. That's why you'd find hospitals made out of caves and farms and apartment buildings. The hospital I worked out of in Syria was out of a basement. And sterility, you know, wasn't great. And you didn't have access to a lot of equipment. And you were just kind of doing the best you could. And I learned a lot from Syrian surgeons because they taught me how to do so much more when you're given very little. The good thing about Ukraine is that at least the hospitals are still functioning. The hospitals aren't being built out of caves. But in Ukraine, we all slept in the hospitals. Everyone lived, the doctors, the nurses, most people lived within the hospitals because it was too dangerous to go home. Or if there was a mass casualty event or a nearby bomb, everyone wanted to be ready. They wanted to have everybody in the hospital that could mobilize instantaneously to take care of people if they got flooded with patients. But at nighttime, we couldn't leave the lights on because they were worried we might get targeted. In Kiev, one hospital I worked at, they said when the Russians were close, they were shooting into the hospital, so they had to cover all the windows with blankets. And then the major issue was if there was, like right now, there's been an onslaught of recent attacks in Ukraine. And the big issue is if the hospital's been hit or if the water supply has been hit, they worry about whether the electricity is going to work, whether the water is going to work, because you need water to scrub into surgery. You need electricity to run anesthesia machines. That was the bigger threat.
You've mentioned that when you left Ukraine in the spring, people were hoping that the war would be over by the summer. Well, months have passed and there are no signs of the war coming to an end. There's escalation. Do you feel a sense of deja vu with what happened in Syria, where people kept assuming that the civil war would come to an end, and yet it's still going on?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to my friends that are there, and many of them haven't seen their wives or their families in several months. And one of the surgeons I worked with working in Zaporizhia hasn't seen his family since February. Oh. He's just been moving from hospital to hospital. But I told him, I said, I'd like to maybe come back in the winter and help you out. And he said, well, we're hoping that the war will be over by then. And I hope so too. I hope that if I do get to go back, it'll be because I'm visiting friends, not because the war is still ongoing.
You've talked, I know, about the romanticized image, probably from culture and media, that many have of the wartime surgeon saving lives in dangerous times and dangerous places. What would you tell our listeners is the reality?
I would say that over time, if it's work that you want to do, you have to be careful because it can take a physical psychic toll, bearing witness to all that suffering. And, you know, I know one surgeon who in Syria that lost, he lost count of all the amputations he was doing, and it can really burn you out. And it's very easy to get overwhelmed with feelings of helplessness and powerlessness and meaninglessness. But you have to find ways also to balance that with the courage and compassion and resilience from the people around you. So that's where I tried to get strength from when I was there. When I was in Ukraine, you know, I saw, in spite of all the bombs, you'd see people in the streets, that civil servants that were still cleaning the streets and running public transport, even the railway workers and people working on the trains in Ukraine to get from one place to the other. You'd have to take trains, and people that worked on the trains just saw it as their duty. And I think it means a lot. Just being there and looking them in the eye and shaking their hand, it's a form of solidarity. And then the last thing is you get to be an advocate. You get to be a voice for them. You get to bear witness and come back and let people know what you saw. Because there are a lot of narratives in war, and you get to speak on their behalf and amplify their voices in areas that otherwise wouldn't be heard.
Thank you so much, Dr. Samer Attar, and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Samer Attar is an associate professor of surgery at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and a volunteer with the Syrian American Medical Society. And that's the show. What Next is produced by Madeline Ducharme, Carmel Del Shad, Elena Schwartz, and Mary Wilson. We're getting some help from Jarrett Dowding and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery and Joanne Levine. And filling in today for Mary Harris, I'm Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and host of the Equal Time podcast. We'll catch you back in this feed tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights. Gay rights now! Gay rights! With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus. Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.